Yes, well, we are going to look at Psalm 130, as Glenn has said, and we'll just read the psalm, which isn't very long, 8 verses, and we're going to consider it, by the way, in 4 sets of 2. So let's read the psalm. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my pleas for mercy. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? But with you there is forgiveness, that you may be feared. I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord, more than watchman for the morning, more than watchman for the morning. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him is plentiful redemption, and he will redeem Israel from his iniquities. Well, as I said, we're going to look at 4 sets of 2 verses, and we will start with the first one, which is going to be verses 1 and 2, the earnestness or the earnest prayer of the psalmists, of the psalmist. Out of the depths I cry unto you. So when we are talking about depths in Scripture, usually it is used in a metaphorical sense of great calamity, great difficulty, great suffering into which we may find ourselves. And sometimes it is used in a literal sense, and when it is used literally, it is to do with water. So when at creation, the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the deep. So the earth was covered with water at the very beginning, not fire, as we may have been taught at school. It was a watery beginning, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the deep. Also in the Red Sea, referring to the Red Sea, Isaiah says, "Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep?" But our consideration today is the metaphorical consideration, the calamity in which we may find ourselves. Psalm 69, I sink in deep mire, where there is no foothold. I have come into deep waters, and the floods sweep over me. So I've had a look at what could characterize the deep in the metaphorical sense by way of our experience. And I've come up with 5 things that may be suggestive to us of what it is like. Number 1, silence. If you are in the deep, you can't be heard, and you don't hear a lot. When I was a kid, I used to surf a lot, and I would often get dumped. You get dumped if you catch the wave too late. And it throws you to the bottom of the sea, and you just roll with the blows. You roll, you get your hair full of sand, and your togs full of sand, and it's no use trying to think I'm going to go up for air, because you're not strong enough. The water is always stronger than you, so you just roll with it. And after a while, the force is spent, the wave is gone, and you can come up again. But when you're under there, all you hear is this water bubbling around you. People may be saying something up in the surface, but you can't hear that. Or if you can, it's rather muffled. So it's characterized by this inability to hear and this inability to be heard. You can try and cry out to someone, but it doesn't particularly work when you're under the water. Unfamiliarity. You are in a foreign environment. Water is not natural to us. We like going swimming, but we keep close to the shore if possible, so we can get back out again if there's a problem. But it is not our natural habitat. It is not our comfort zone, to use a rather hackneyed term. Everything is now your comfort zone. Well, that is not your comfort zone. Number 3, it is characterized often by suffering. Whether emotional or psychological or physical or spiritual, this is what it is like to be in the deep. Agitation and confusion also characterize the deep, also characterize the seas. Revelation talks about the beast who comes out of the seas. He arises out of the Gentile world in all its ferment and its agitation, is the suggestion that when the term seas are used, this is what it is like. The roaring of the sea, that's what it does. It roars. I had a look this week at the number of shipwrecks that surround the Australian coast. Now, the Australian coast is fairly long, as you know, 25,000 something kilometres. But there are something like 8,000 shipwrecks around the coastline of Australia. And of those 8,000, only 2,000 have been located. So in other words, there's the 6,000 shipwrecks that we don't even know where they are, which of course represent a lot of people who have gone down into the deep with them. So it is really not a the safest place to be in the deep. If you think of Britain, it became an empire largely through conquering the deep. They became a maritime nation. Therefore, they could go everywhere and claim land and so on. They overcame the fear. And maritime nations tend to do that because they have to do that. But again, it never becomes natural to us. I never want to be left out in the sea. I'm not really keen on drowning. I'll stay here if I can. Also, you might like to avoid going on cruises around Scandinavia. That's not the best idea these days. Number four is guilt. We become acutely conscious of our sin and our failure when we are in the deep. Maybe not so much beforehand, but when we get into deep waters, then we become aware of how far short we may have fallen. Now remember Jonah that Mitch preached about a few weeks ago. Jonah was the prophet. God told him to go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it. In Jonah chapter 1, verse 2, go and do that. What did he do? He did the precise reverse. He went the precise opposite direction. Instead of going east, he went west to Tarshish on a ship. And as you know the story, was thrown into the water, ended up in the belly of a great fish, and there he cried out to God. He hadn't been praying before, but now he did. Now he became aware of his guilt. And it's interesting because it says in chapter 1 and verse 2, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it. We go through all his experiences in the fish, being vomited out onto the land, and now we come to chapter 3, and again says, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it. The exact same words in the third chapter that you found in the first chapter. In other words, if you choose disobedience, God will bring you right back to that exact point where you failed and you didn't do what you were called upon to do, where you chose to go your way and not God's way in that respect. Well, obedience is the lesson that we all must learn. Go your own way, but God will bring you back. Number five, the fifth characteristic, the impetus to pray. As I said, Jonah had not prayed before. All through chapter 1 into chapter 2, he hadn't been praying. He'd just been doing his thing. But when he gets into chapter 3 in the belly of the whale, or chapter 2, he is praying. I called out to the Lord in my distress. He answered me out of the belly of Sheol. I cried, and he heard my voice. The default response for a Christian is to cry out to God. I cry to you, O Lord. That is the natural response if a believer falls into deep waters for whatever reason, whether of their own making or just simply that has been the order of God that they should do that. Whereas the unbeliever, it is actually the precise opposite when you look at it. Well, think of Job. Now, this is a man who certainly did fall into deep waters. You know, it must be the worst thing that it could ever happen as to what happened to him in one day. Job, the richest man in the East, and a man who worshipped God. His heart was perfect toward God. And yet in one day, he lost everything. He had cattle, he had oxen, he had sheep, he had camels, he had donkeys. He lost them all. Some were stolen by the Sabaeans came down, raided, took them away. Fire came out of heaven, destroyed his flocks of sheep and the keepers. And in each case, one servant escaped to tell him the news. You've lost all this. He hadn't hardly finished, and another one came. All this is gone. All the way through, all his possessions. And then finally, the last one and the most devastating one, a man comes and says, all your sons and all your daughters were in the house of the oldest brother eating and drinking, and a wind came, struck the four corners of the house, it collapsed, and they are all dead. All your sons, all your daughters. So we read in Job 1, verse 20, then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground, and worshipped. And he said, naked I came out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. I grew up, of course, I was born after the war, a long time after the war, and I... a Vietnam War, actually. and of course, a lot of people around me had been through the war. My parents had been through the war, and lots of people. I worked with people who had been through the war. Often I heard people say, I believed in God until the war. When the war came, I stopped believing in God. Or some tragedy befell our family, then I stopped believing in God. Now, the fact is, they never really did believe in the first place. They certainly had not believed unto righteousness before these things happened. But it is the tribulation, it is the difficulty that brings out what the person really is, what is in their heart. Whether God has changed them or not, that is what comes out when the tribulation hits. That does not mean that a Christian cannot complain when difficulty strikes them. I have heard it, you have heard it, people saying it's just not fair. And I've heard that from believers, true Christians, it's just not fair. But that will change. It always does. It always changes. Eventually, they will say, God has done it, done well in my life. It was for good. I see it was for good. And the worship will come out of the heart of the true believer. So tribulation proves what is in the heart. General Robert E. Lee was the commander of the Confederate forces in the Civil War. And he was a Christian man, by the way, great man. He came one day, he was in Kentucky, came up to a house, and in the front of this house was a magnificent tree that had been tremendously damaged and defaced by Union artillery. A woman came out of the house angry and bitter and said to the general, look at my tree. She wanted him to commiserate with her. She wanted him to say, oh, those terrible Yankees, look what they have done. And the general said to her, chop it down, my dear madam, and forget it. And this is what we must all do. The great calamities that befall us, finally we must say, chop it down, forget it. It may have been hard. It may be difficult. It may still be with me. But chop it down. Because I believe in my God that he commands all things and he does all things well. O Lord, hear my voice. Verse 2. If nothing else, that just he hears my voice. Spurgeon said this, C.H. Spurgeon, the great preacher, it is better for our prayer to be heard than to be answered. Well, I always thought, well, you know, if it's heard, therefore, it's answered, surely. But there is a difference between our prayer being heard and our prayer being answered. If all our prayers were answered, well, we would be the masters of our own destinies. And the world would not be a pretty place, I don't think, if all our prayers were answered. But that God hears our prayers is our great consolation. Because he may choose not to answer the prayer we want, but he has heard us. And in this, the psalmist takes great comfort. He has heard my prayer. So the question is not so much how many prayers have been answered, but how many prayers have been heard. God does not hear the prayers of the wicked. He hears our prayers. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my pleas for mercy. When we have offered our prayers, we need to pray over our prayers. Some people say, you only need to pray once, that's it. It's done. Okay, maybe. But the psalmist didn't feel that way. He went back and he prayed over them again. Verses 3 and 4, the humble confession of the psalmist. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? If you mark them, who could stand? The problem, I think, in the contemporary church is that we have devalued or downplayed iniquities, sin. The church does tend to follow the culture. In every country, the natural tendency is to follow the culture. If the culture does not think much of sin, often you will see that in the church. And what does our culture think about sin? Well, it doesn't really. If you say the word sin, they may think, maybe some sexual indiscretion. That's sin. But that's it. That's all. And yet, scripturally, it is a tremendous offense against God. We tend not to think that God is offended. We just think of ourselves. I need to be redeemed. I need to be saved. I need to, you know, avoid punishment. But what about God? What about the offense that sin causes a holy and righteous God? If you should mark iniquity, O Lord, who could stand? So there is the importance of what we could call the negative. And I read a few verses from, a few lines from Francis Schaeffer this week in his book, Death in the City. Francis Schaeffer was a very well-known evangelical in the last century, had tremendous effect, particularly in America. He said this, people often say to me, what would you do if you met a really modern man on a train and you had just an hour to talk with him about the gospel? I would spend 45 or 50 minutes on the negative to show him his real dilemma, to show him that he is more dead than even he thinks he is. That he is not just dead in the 20th century meaning of dead, that is, having no significance in this life, but that he is morally dead because he is separated from the God who exists. Then I would take 10 or 15 minutes to tell him the gospel. So if there is an error in the modern church, it is to run to the good news too soon without delivering the bad news. You know, it is the sick who need the physician, not the well. So often we need to be convinced of our ailment before we're interested in what the doctor says. And that's what he's saying. Consider the word propitiation. Now, if we were to take a little survey, who knows what propitiation means? We probably would. Well, this is one of those words that if you knew what it was meant yesterday, you'll probably have forgotten by today. Propitiation. Well, there is, of course, we know what redemption means generally, salvation, justification, sanctification. So, what about propitiation? Now, it's not used a lot in the New Testament, but if you think of the word to propitiate, you know, or propitious, this is a propitious. A propitious occasion means everything is suitable, everything kind of fits, it's comfortable, it's going to work, it's propitious, you know. But in the New Testament, this word does appear. It's the Greek word halasterion, and it means to avert wrath, to avert anger. You need to propitiate that person because he's really angry. You know, go and speak to them, and you know, give them a bunch of flowers or something to quell their anger. Of course, this is not a popular word because modern people don't like to think of the idea that God is angry with us. You know, we can be angry. Sometimes we can be angry with God. But God angry with us, you know, that is really goes against the grain. That suggests guilt of some sort. So it is not, as I say, a popular idea. Nevertheless, there it is in the New Testament. Now, when the Apostle Paul uses this word in Romans, he is talking about the work of Christ, and he said in Romans 3, Jesus Christ, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he passed over former sins. So he is now talking about the sins of everybody in the Old Testament, if you like. Everyone before Christ. How could God have forgiven people? How could God have forgiven the psalmist who says, who's speaking about, if you should mark iniquities, no one's going to stand. And yet he was forgiven. He was forgiven on the basis of this, that God set forth his son later in time as this word, propitiation. Also, it was to show his righteousness at the present time, that is now where we are, that he might be just and the justifier of him who believes in Jesus, that God might be just, that God in forgiving you, that God in forgiving the psalmist 900 years ago was righteous. So again, how does this word propitiation work? Well, you know, in the day of atonement, special day, the singular day in the Jewish calendar, when it was a fast day, and the high priest would take these two goats, one would be confessed over all the sins of Israel, that goat would be taken out of the wilderness, picturing our sin being removed from us, far, far from us, never to be seen again. The second goat was slain, the blood was taken of that goat, the high priest would take that blood into the holiest of all, sprinkling the blood before the ark and on the ark. The ark, that box that sat in the holy place, it had a lid on the top, gold, covered with gold, called the mercy seat. Also the same word is used there, halasterion, for propitiation. And the blood was there. And God's presence dwelt there. It was the only time when God dwelt upon earth apart from in men and women. In that day, God dwelt in the ark, up above the ark, in the holiest of all. God said, that's where I'm going to fellowship with you. From above the ark, or above the mercy seat, from between the cherubim of glory, these golden angels that looked at each other and looked down upon the lid, there God said, I'm going to fellowship with you. There the high priest would meet with God. The only place upon earth that God ordained that he would meet with men. So the blood comes in, and the blood is placed on this particular point, just below where the presence of God is. Now, if you consider what is in the ark, the box underneath, what was in it? Well, there were the tables of stone, the law, two tables of the law. At one point, there was a pot of manna, there was Aaron's rod that budded. They disappeared. When it comes to Solomon's temple, it is only the tables of the law that are there. So if you picture that, you have two tables of the law broken. Not physically broken, morally broken. Man is guilty of breaking this law. Above it, the mercy seat. Upon the mercy seat, the blood. Above that, the presence of God. Between a broken law and God's presence is the blood of the propitiatory sacrifice, he who has been set forth as a propitiation, turning aside the wrath and accounting for that great offense against a holy God, the blood of Christ for us. So sin therefore becomes this serious thing. And if anybody should, if God should mark it, we will not stand. But he has provided for it in that sacrifice. But with you there is forgiveness, verse 4, that you may be feared. The man and the woman who fears God is the forgiven man and woman. Now, many people say, I don't fear God. And they may say, I don't worry about judgment to come. If a person has no gratitude, they have no fear. That is in the biblical sense. This is not that craven fear of terror. Now, this is a fear of respect, of tremendous respect. Only those who are forgiven can fear God in this sense. So, with you there is forgiveness, that you may be feared. Verses 5 and 6, the resolve to wait. I wait for the Lord, my soul waits and in his word I hope, my soul waits for the Lord. Wait, that Hebrew word wait, is not just passing time. It has the idea of tension or twisting or stretching. There is stress involved in this kind of waiting. And this, of course, this stress does something for us. It does something in our lives. Stress produces strength. So we wait for the Lord, as difficult as it is. Three times he says, I wait, my soul waits, my soul waits. The Lord's people are a waiting people. In the first Advent, Simeon was waiting for the consolation of Israel. Anna the prophetess spoke to all those who are waiting for redemption in Israel. Yet most of Israel was not waiting. It was only some at the first Advent. Some, or the majority, did not even recognize him. They did not even know that their time of their visitation had come. Their Messiah was here. Only some. The second Advent, to the Thessalonian Christians, Paul wrote about how they turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven. So the whole church, in a sense, is in this waiting mode. We are waiting for him to come. And in his word do I hope. My soul waits for the Lord, and between those two phrases is, in his word do I hope. Hope sustains our waiting, or our waiting is sustained by our hope. Hope has to do with the future. Faith is now. You know, we believe now. But hope is the same, has the same strong substance, but it is what's going to happen. Therefore, if we die in hope of the resurrection. We are dead sure it's going to happen. My soul waits for the Lord more than watchman for the morning, more than watchman for the morning. In the Hebrew, it reads like this. My soul waits for the Lord more than they that watch for the morning, watch for the morning. He just repeated the phrase as if it couldn't be put in a better way. We are waiting for the morning, like the watchman who stands at the city wall, straining to see, guarding the city. Is anyone coming? Is any invader coming as dawn approaches? Once dawn has come, they relax. Or the woman sitting by the sick with the fever. All through the night, the fever rages. We wait for the morning when the fever hopefully will break. We are looking for the dawning of the day. Finally, the last two verses, the joyful expectation that he has, O Israel, hope in the Lord. For with the Lord there is steadfast love, with him plentiful redemption. Steadfast love, we've mentioned before, is hesed. Yeah, I can't say that, but hesed. Which has this idea of something that is very strong, something that is solid, something that is a movement. It is not fickle, it's not sentimental. It is steadfast. It is loyal. It is the love of God that remains. And he will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. Our iniquities, or man's iniquities, are our greatest danger. We may think, you know, just to be a better person is really what it's all about. To be a nicer individual. No, our greatest enemy are our iniquities. It's guilt. Guilt is man's problem. Guilt is man's supreme problem. And he needs redemption. While propitiation deals with the offense against a holy God, redemption deals with our lost estate, the lost estate of man. For you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. Amen. Bless you.
Thanks, Peter. I always